but time is now of the essence. So if you've been meaning to make a gift, don't delay. Call 217-244-9455 or go online to willpledge.org. Thank you.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We'd like to begin today's program by taking a look at this week's primaries. A number of congressional and state-level nominees were selected on Tuesday, and people are still talking about a few notable races in places like New York, Maryland, and Mississippi. To the surprise of some who saw a Tea Party resurgence in some previous outcomes, incumbents seem to fare well across the board, including establishment Republicans whose candidates beat Tea Party-backed candidates in Mississippi, Colorado, and Oklahoma. In Maryland, the current Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown won the Democratic nomination for governor. He thanked his father, an immigrant from Jamaica, in his victory speech.
He came here because he believed that if you work hard and play by the rules, you can pursue your dream and the American dream and make a contribution.
If Brown wins, he would become the first African-American governor of that state, and some say his is a career to watch. We wanted to talk about all of this, so we've called, once again, Charles Mattesian. He's a senior political editor for NPR, and he's back with us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Charlie, thanks so much for taking the long road upstairs.
Hi, Michelle. Great to be here again.
Also joining us, Andra Gillespie. She's a professor of political science at Emory University and is author of The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America. She's with us from the studios at Emory University in Atlanta. Andra, welcome back to you as well. Thank you for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me.
So, Charlie, let me start with you. Any headline from Tuesday that you want to tell us about?
Well, I think the marquee race that everybody was watching and probably was the most revealing about the state of the political scene in 2014 would have been Mississippi, where everyone expected that Senator Tad Cochran was a goner after the June 3rd primary. You know, almost all the trend lines suggested that, you know, he was going to be in big trouble. There was, you know, not only there was polling that showed he was down, all the momentum seemed to be with his challenger. There didn't really seem to be a pathway to victory for him yet. Ultimately, he pulled it out against Chris McDaniel with a pretty politically risky and novel strategy of appealing to independent votes, Republicans who didn't vote in the primary, and also African-American Democrats.
And why was that novel? I mean, why was that novel? I mean, you just think that that's not the kind of thing you do until the general election? Or
well, it's something? Not the kind of thing that you see Mississippi Republicans do. Number one, they don't need to because of the numbers, but also it's just not the thing. It's not a strategy you see Republicans resorting to in primaries, and it kind of tells you a little bit about the dire circumstances he was in, but it also suggests something about the kind of record he had amassed that he was even able to make a plausible case to African-American Democrats as to why it might make sense to show up and cast votes for him in the Republican runoff.
I'll be interested to hear more about whether this has future implications for how, you know, campaigns run, because we talk about how the fact that the electorate is so polarized along, you know, all these different lines. So, Andra, what about you? What were you paying attention to on primary night? What races captured your attention?
Well, Mississippi, Oklahoma, Maryland, and Harlem. You know, all of these races featured African-American candidates of different parties, all of which with different expectations of whether or not they were going to win, and we have different outcomes there as well. You know, I will say that I'm not terribly surprised that Thad Cochran would run to win African-American voters. While it's an underused strategy, it's actually not unusual in southern states with open primaries for people to sometimes jump parties to try to pick elections. When you live in a state with one-party rule, sometimes you do actually want to participate in the other party's election if you're in the minority party, just so that you have a say in who your representative is.
Talk to me a little bit about Oklahoma. You said you had your eye on that as well.
So in one of the special Senate primary, T.W. Shannon, who is the Speaker of the Oklahoma, former Speaker of the Oklahoma House, an African-American Republican, was running for the nomination and for the Republican Party, and he eventually ended up losing in that particular race to a Republican congressman from the state as well. And so it was really interesting. I don't think people thought that the race was going to end up being as decisive as it was. People anticipated a runoff, and Shannon only got about a third of the vote. It's actually interesting to look at the counties where he did win outright or win a plurality, and a lot of those places either had larger than average black populations or larger than average Native American populations. I think some people thought with the success of somebody like Tim Scott in South Carolina that we were seeing the resurgence of African American Republicans, and while I think that we are increasingly going to see more African American Republican nominees and actual elected officials, whether we're talking about members of Congress or Senate or even at the the state level, you know, we still see that there's still plenty of room and progress to be made there and still many glass ceilings to crack at various levels.
Interesting. We're going to hear from Tim Scott in just a few minutes. We're going to talk a little bit about something else. He's become an important conservative voice on the whole question of poverty and how poverty should be addressed. We're going to hear from him a little later. Charlie, what about the whole question of the state of the Tea Party and whether it still remains a force in American politics? Did we learn anything?
Well, I think overall it was not, if you're keeping score at home, it was not a great night for the Tea Party. Chris McDaniel was sort of its signature candidate in Mississippi, and Cochran was probably the Tea Party's last best remaining chance to take down an incumbent. They have a couple of opportunities coming up, but they are not as well positioned as in Mississippi. But, I mean, I think, you know, the ideas of writing the Tea Party's obit, it just really misses the mark. The Tea Party, you know, at least in my estimation, is definitely not dead. You can still see it leaving its mark in elections, in House elections, in open seat House elections in particular. You see it leaving its mark in moving the party to the right and on Capitol Hill. But I do think what we're now discovering about the Tea Party is we're beginning to see the outlines of the outer limits of what they can accomplish. Meaning, for example, incumbents no longer get caught sleeping the way they used to. And I think another change that you see is that Republicans and their supporters in the business community now understand that they can't sit back. They're taking on the Tea Party head on in a way that they were much more reticent about doing in the 2012 election cycle. So I think you're beginning to see almost a maturing of the fight between the two. And so I don't think that this is the end in any way for Tea Party.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the primaries that took place earlier this week, and we're talking about what the headlines are from those. With us are Charles Mattesian. He's a senior political editor for NPR, and Andra Gillespie is a professor of political science at Emory University. So Professor Gillespie, one person generating buzz. You talked a little about the kind of the rising class, if we could call it that, of African-American politicians. Mm-hmm. That's next wave. Maryland's Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown is now poised to become the first African-American governor of that state. That's because, you know, the Democrats are so dominant in Maryland, and the winner of the Democratic primary is usually, you know, heavily advantaged in the fall. Tell us a little bit about Anthony Brown, if you would, and is his a career that is kind of worth watching, and if so, why?
Absolutely. I had the pleasure of meeting him actually a couple of months ago when he was in Atlanta doing some fundraising. And he's got, you know, an interesting story. Harvard grad, Army veteran. He's been lieutenant governor of the state under Martin O'Malley. He helped to sort of spearhead the creation of Maryland's Exchange. And while one of his opponents actually tried to use that against him, running ads in Maryland that almost looked like Republican ads against Anthony Brown, Brown emerged victorious. He's got an interesting story. Grew up in New York, I believe, the son of a Jamaican doctor and a Norwegian immigrant mother, or a mother of Norwegian background. So, I mean, he definitely has an Obama-esque type of story, but with the defense credential. So if he wanted to do something later on, I don't know what his future plans are beyond the governor's office. It's definitely available to him. This is actually a time where Maryland is kind of coming full circle. You know, it was just in 2006 that Kwesi Mfume did not win the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate against Ben Cardin. And so we're now coming into a place where African Americans are really coming into the fore politically and taking advantage of their numbers. They're taking advantage of demographic shifts in the state. So as we've seen Washington, D.C.'s black population decline, Maryland's black population has grown. Proportionally, there are as many blacks in Maryland as there are in Mississippi. And so this is a state that students of African American politics need to pay attention to.
And so, Charlie, before we let you go, a couple minutes left, I want to talk about this whole issue of executive of power. We're kind of making a turn here. That House Speaker John Boehner says he plans to move forward with a lawsuit against President Obama for abuse and misuse of executive power. He's talking about his decision to move forward with this lawsuit. Here it is.
Mm-hmm. The Constitution makes it clear that a president's job is to faithfully execute the laws. And in my view, the president has not faithfully executed the laws.
And as we are speaking, the Supreme Court has just issued a ruling that would limit the president's power to make recess appointments. And I just sort of wonder, all this together, I know this is just very recent news here, but is this going to have an impact on the president's ability to function through the remainder of his term. I mean, the president's been arguing that why he needed to make these recess appointments is that Congress has been so uncooperative and that he just can't sit on his hands and not allow this administration to function. I just wanted to get your perspective on these developments.
I think the Boehner lawsuit is operating at two levels, and I don't think either of them, at least in the Obama presidency, is going to have a profound impact. The first one is it's a reflection of the traditional kinds of constitutional tensions we see between the legislative and executive branches. But I think there's also a political level to the suit, and what you're seeing is, in many ways, an articulation of the Republican argument against the Republican or against the Obama White House, and that is designed solely for a political constituency because so many Republicans believe that. And I think the timing of it is, you know, no secret. I mean, it's coming before the midterm elections, and it enables Republicans to in some ways outline their argument against the Obama White House, and it helps at least underscore to their base their commitment to getting out the message about what they feel is the fatal flaw of the Obama administration, which...
Do you feel that this lawsuit has substantive merit, or is it mainly a political document?
Well, you know, without having read it and seen it, you know, I'm hesitant to speak on the substantive merits of it, but clearly there's a political angle to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it walks you through almost exactly what the case has been made against the Obama administration and its agenda and how it has attempted to accomplish that in Washington.
Hmm. Charles Mentesian is a senior political editor here at NPR. He was with us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Andra Gillespie is a professor of political science at Emory University, and she joined us from the studios at the university. A lot to talk about today. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, not all conferences are about golf outings and gabbing by the pool. We'll hear from GOP Senator Tim Scott about a conference he attended this week on making the economy work. And we'll hear from a small business owner who spoke at the White House Summit on Working Families on the role small businesses can play.
You know, when a small business owner opens a business, the last thing you think about is your employees, frankly.
That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
The new film Obvious Child is about a stand-up comic in her 20s who gets pregnant after a night of casual sex.
We wanted to make a romantic comedy with a very funny leading lady who has a safe, regrets-free, shame-free abortion.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the film's director, Gillian Robespierre, and its star, Jenny Slate. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA, examining the role of non-white people in, geekdom.
There's a lot of crossover between social justice and sci-fi, and it's going to be more and more because of places like Twitter, because we're having these conversations and we're coming closer together, and our voices are becoming unified.
Diversity in fantasy and science fiction, that's this week on Latino USA.
Saturday evenings at 8 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. This is the time of year when people in many industries and professions hold conferences, and people interested in politics and policy are no different. So we thought we'd take a minute to dip into two of the meatier conferences going on this week in Washington. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a small business owner who took part in the White House-sponsored event, the White House Summit on Working Families. But first, we're joined by Senator Tim Scott. The South Carolina Republican was one of the featured guests at this week's National Journal Summit, The Next America, Making America Work. The event highlighted ways of improving economic opportunities, particularly in minority communities. And Senator Scott, who's African-American, has become an important leading conservative voice focused on building wealth among people of color. Senator Tim Scott, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. It is good to be with you.
So what did you talk about in your remarks?
Well, I talked about my personal story, my personal journey from poverty to at least some minuscule prosperity. And it really focused on, A, the power of education. It started off with the power of a switch. My mama loved me with a apparatus, southern apparatus of encouragement. I didn't appreciate it then, but I appreciate it now. It's called discipline. But I talked about three real pathways to creating wealth in America. Homeownership is a part of that path. Business ownership or entrepreneurship is part of that path. And then understanding how to have an equity position in the marketplace, whether it's mutual funds or stocks. You have to be in a position of ownership really to experience true wealth in America. And so while I want to find ways to help people escape poverty, I think we have to ignite the conversation around prosperity so as to create more business owners who will then employ people who come from those areas where we want the most help.
Why do you think you were invited to this event? Did you have a special role to play?
I think the good Lord has provided me with a mess that I created when I was younger that has become my message so I could be a messenger of hope and opportunity. And so what I really did was share my own personal journey and then talk about how my journey reflects that same journey of so many other folks who have succeeded. And so I don't see it as an elected official. I see it as an entrepreneur. I spent most of my life as an entrepreneur, adult life as an entrepreneur.
What was your business?
I had a couple of Allstate insurance agencies. I had a real estate company and dabbled with cleaning for a little while. But I started selling and working for myself, selling Krispy Kreme donuts and vacuums, Kirby vacuums door-to-door, Amway distributor as a young fella, all looking for ways to make my ends come together, helping my mother, who was a single mom, support the family and pay bills in high school and in college.
I'm curious about that. I'm interested in that because traditionally, at least in the current era, the Republican Party is identified with a message of get out of the way of business. That the best way to build prosperity is to get out of the way of the prosperity builders. Now, obviously, there are a lot of people who believe that that message isn't actually thoroughly embraced when it comes to certain favored industries. So we can, but that's, you know, that's a whole different conversation. We can set that aside. But other people feel that the government has a role, particularly when it comes to minorities, in ensuring fairness, because the government has been in the past an active player in ensuring unfairness, for example, actively discriminating against certain people. And so they feel that now the job of government is to remove those obstacles and to be like a vigilant guardian of fair opportunity. And I just wanted to know how you see that question.
There's a careful balance that can be created where you look at the challenges of the past, you look at the success of the future, and you find your path forward. I recently attended the 50-year anniversary and celebration of the Civil Rights Movement. And if you look at how that came together back in the 60s, what seems to be an unknown fact was that Republicans and Democrats voted at high numbers, Republicans a slightly higher number than Democrats, for that legislation. And so the fact is that while we have a very curious and provocative past as a country, the question is how do we move forward as one nation?
Do you feel the major task now is incremental in the sense of, you know, a program here, a tweak there, or do you feel that there's some kind of underlying, you know, philosophical shift that needs to take place in order to create the kind of prosperity that one would hope to see that would be shared among the many and not just the few?
I think most often when we talk increments, we're really talking short-term hopes of something happening in a big way that typically doesn't manifest, that we've spent a lot of time and resources trying to make it happen. I'm more of a long-term person. It's just how I am. When I run my businesses, I'm always looking 5 years down the road. And so when I think about policies and or philosophies that will create a permanent change for those folks most vulnerable economically. I don't think of short-term solutions. I think of long-term transformation. And that, for me, starts with education. The fact of the matter is that when you look at the unemployment rates, I see those as symptoms. I think of problems as the graduation rates, when you look at the, especially specifically in the Black community. And so I take that and I transpose that same philosophy in business. And I find that as a small business owner, there were two major impediments to my success. One was access to capital. And there's some things that we can do to help create incentives to having more access to capital. I spoke Saturday afternoon with Bob Johnson, the founder of BET, about how we can work on ways to create more access to capital. And the second is having a strong, clear business plan and vision on how to make your business succeed.
It's believed now that reaching out to Black voters may have saved the political career of one of your colleagues, Mississippi Senator Thad Cochran.
It's probably true.
And so I wanted to ask about that, if whether do you feel that that race has changed the dynamics a bit of how the Republican Party views Black voters. I mean, it's not a secret that the Republicans have viewed Black voters as kind of a hard sell, and many African-Americans feel that they make only kind of nominal and token efforts to reach out to them. And, you know, the feeling is that it's kind of a wasted effort because the voters are so entrenched in the Democratic Party. And so I just wondered whether you think that that race, since this is your region, not your state, but your region, you think it's changed anything in how people view that?
I think what I've learned in my previous races is you typically find an audience where you're willing to go. And so it's our responsibility as elected officials and specifically as Republicans to go into every single corridor of our district. And for me, I see that not simply in South Carolina, but nationwide. I want to change the dynamics, not politically, but I want to change the dynamics economically. I want to change the dynamics of hope in this country. And so that's where I'm coming from. But I think the answer to your question is, I think Thad Cochran's race proves that if you spend enough time and you're sincere, authentic, and hungry, you can have success in places where others say you can't have success. And frankly, as much as Republicans need a better job reaching out to the Black community and minority communities, we have to make sure that minority communities are willing to embrace and at least listen to the message that comes from folks who have an R. And so that's a two-way path, and I've experienced it when I speak in different places, that folks are already made up their mind on what I'm going to say. And then after I speak, they're like, oh my gosh, that makes sense. You really want to help poor kids get a better education? You want single moms to have the type of flexibility at work so they can take care of their kids? Well, I was a poor kid raised by a single mom. Why would I not care about those issues? It's because of these stereotypical labels that we place on people, and we don't give individuals an opportunity to speak for themselves.
And before we let you go, one more question. I wanted to end where we began on the conferences and the summit that you participated in.
Yes,
what's the value of that? You know, some people look at that and they tend to be invited audiences, a few people who are already kind of very well positioned in their lives. What's the value of participating in something like that?
I'll tell you that what I saw in the audience, which was very different than I see in most of those prepared audiences, I saw a ton of young people, amazing diversity, and I saw people listening not only with their ears but with their eyes, and I believe that means that their hearts were engaged. If we have an opportunity just to start a debate, a conversation about multiple paths forward, the benefit is those folks take that conversation out of the room and perhaps invite speakers to come into their communities and have that conversation, or they start doing the research and having those conversations with their friends. What changed my life was having the ability to have a relationship with a small business owner who was the South Carolina Minority Business Owner of the Year. And when the banks were not impressed with my business plan, I had the opportunity to convince one of the folks who had watched me work for over a decade. He was one of my clients. Then invest in my business to help me get started. And then I had enough seed capital to go back to the banks and get a small $20,000 line of credit, which then helped create the insurance business, the real estate business, and everything else. So the power of relationships, perhaps, is the clearest answer to your question.
Senator Tim Scott is a Republican. He's the junior senator from South Carolina, but he was kind enough to stop by our studios in Washington, D.C. Senator Scott, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Yes, ma'am, Michelle.
Now we'd like to hear from one of the panelists at this week's White House Summit on Working Families. The event focused on ways that businesses can support the needs of working families. Andy Shalal is the owner of the Washington, D.C.-based restaurant chain Busboys and Poets. It's a gathering place not just for people who want to eat, but also for artists and people who are involved in politics. We've been talking to him from time to time over the years about how he's faring as a small business owner in these challenging economic times. Andy Shalal, welcome back to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
Why do you think you were selected to be part of this conference?
You know, I own a group of businesses, and I think I am in an industry that is a little bit difficult in a sense of how it's coming into this idea of improving conditions for workers. So there are over 10 million people that are involved in tipped wages in the restaurant industry. And so it opens up this new dialogue that we've been having about increasing the minimum wage, increasing the tip wage, and changing the paradigm of how restaurants have been run. For years, restaurants have been basically the last to come into this professionalism of an industry. And I think that's why I was brought in.
Well, also, you're at the cutting edge of one of the more intense debates that we've been having both between the political parties and people with different philosophies about the best way to assist families. I mean, I think most people know that wages have been stagnant for, you know, quite some time in this country now. And a lot of people have been pushing for an increase in the minimum wage. As you know, then restaurant workers, the tipped minimum wage is a lot lower than the regular minimum wage. What's your philosophy on that?
Well, you know, the restaurant industry employs a lot of minimum wage and tip wage workers. So we have to address that issue if we want to raise the boats for everybody. So I was brought into it because I've been in that conversation about raising the minimum wage. We started with the idea of the national minimum wage we have, which is $7.25 an hour. It's $8.25 an hour here in D.C. was not enough to really make any kind of a living. So if you're going to work full time, you should be able to at least feed your family, have a roof over your head, and be able to go to and from work. That's the basics. Unfortunately, with that kind of wage, it's impossible in this city or in any city, really, for that matter. So we start looking at other ways. People talk about a living wage. Living wage is hard to talk about because I don't know what that means. Is it an amount of money that somebody needs to make to raise a family of four? You know, everybody has different needs, and a living wage to someone may mean something totally different to somebody else.
So how much do you pay?
We started at $10.25 an hour, and now we're raising it to $11.50 an hour this year. Now, the D.C. Council has raised the minimum wage. By 2016, it should be up to $11.50. There's also a push to try to push it higher. But the tip wage has never been really talked about because in this city, the tip wage is not such a problem. When people think of the tip wage, which is only, I think, $2.77 an hour here in this city, that's how much somebody's making. They're making the difference between $2.77 and the minimum wage at the very least.
So I think what I'm guessing is part of the reason that you were brought in to participate is that you are a business owner. A lot of the argument has been that business owners hate this idea of raising the minimum wage. You're asking them to bear the full cost of the difficulties in the economy right now. It'll kill business. Your business is growing. I assume part of your testimony is you've got how many restaurants now?
We have five, actually. We employ over 500 employees.
We'll and be you're adding, growing. You've been adding.
We'll you're be adding 200 more employees this year.
Obviously, you're in conversation with lots of other small business people. Do they like your perspective on this? Well, do they like you speaking out about this? Or
change is hard to come by. So when people have been used to a certain paradigm, a certain structure, you know, it's really hard to change that. You know, when a small business owner opens a business, the last thing you think about is your employees, frankly. When you're opening a small business, let's say you open a small restaurant here, a small family business, you're worried about permitting, you're worried about construction, you're worried about finding money to be able to build the business, you're worried about the menu. So you set up all of these things, and then in the end you say, oh, well, we need to have people. We need to have a dishwasher, we need to have a waiter, we need to have a cook, we need to have people like that to be able to work. And so you look next door and you see, what are they doing next door? Okay, so they pay their dishwashers this much. That must be the prevailing wage. That's what I'll offer. And so there's no real understanding of how you can begin with saying, how can we make it good for the employee to begin with? Because ultimately, they're the ones that are going to make you succeed. So if you begin with that, then you change all your structures along that. So you'll change your menu prices. Now, we're talking about menu prices that may be tweaked just a little bit to be able to give somebody a higher wage. It's not like you're going to raise the price of a burger by double.
Can I ask you, what do you think is the value of a summit like this? I mean, we're spending some time today talking about, we just spoke earlier with Senator Tim Scott, who's participating in another summit about, you know, American business and the economy. And what is there a value to these kinds of get-togethers? I mean, some people think these are basically kind of a PR stunts for whatever entity is sponsoring them to be nice to their friends, to showcase people who agree with them politically and things like that. I mean, what's the value to you in participating in something like this?
Well, to me, it felt like a pep rally. I mean, if anybody's ever played sports, a pep rally is very important to get the team on board, to get everybody kind of excited about something. So it really did feel like a pep rally. And also, to be in business and to be around a lot of business people that are all doing the same, there's a lot of peer pressure to move this ball forward. So I think there's a huge amount of value in having lots of people come together on a sort of a joint effort. And they start pushing each other to go to the next level. That's a good thing.
Did you find it helpful in any way? Is there something you learned as a part of participating in this experience that you might not otherwise have known, or somebody you would have met that you would not have otherwise met?
Well, that I'm not alone in this. That there's a lot of people that are very successful, that have done really well, that have offered much better situations and benefits than even we offer. There are companies that have no sick leave or vacation policies. And I'm trying to understand what that is, where people just take off whenever they want to, come to work when they want to, as long as they get the job done. Now, in some industries, that's very possible. In my industry, it's much more challenging in a restaurant business because there's a lunch hour and there's a dinner hour and people come to eat during certain specific times. You can't just postpone the dining time till later. So we have a special challenge. And I think if we can raise the standards of the restaurant industry, I think it will make a huge impact on the whole economy in this country.
Andy Shalal is owner of the Busboys and Poets restaurant chain. It's based in the Washington, D.C. area. He was kind enough to stop by our Washington, D.C. studios. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, Oscar-winning actress Lupita Nyong'o made a big entrance onto the world stage a year ago, but her father says she's always been a star.
I remember in kindergarten, when she was 5, we went to a parents' day, and she was leading a bunch of kids on the stage.
Peter Anyang Nyong'o shares his stories of raising Lupita and his own fascinating journey as a political dissident and now senator. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carnegie Corporation, supporting the New Americans campaign and all their partners promoting citizenship. More at greatimmigrants.carnegie.org. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives. On the web at hewlett.org. From Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at cancercenter.com. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Our resident chef, Kathy Gunn, says this time of year is all about fish.
Not just fish.
Not just fish.
Summer fish.
What's the difference?
Well, it's interesting. You don't tend to think of something like fish and seafood as being seasonal, but in fact, it very much is.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
On the next Great Performances at the Met, an exciting young cast stars in Franco Zeffirelli's lavish production of La Boheme, which tells the story of passionate poet Rodolfo and his fragile lover Mimi. The performance features a cast of hundreds, an onstage snow scene, and a detailed reconstruction of the Latin Quarter in Paris. Watch La Boheme on Great Performances at the Met, Friday night at 8 on WILL-TV.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. So who am I thinking about right now? She is on the cover of this month's Vogue magazine. She signed up for the next Star Wars film, and People magazine crowned her the most beautiful woman in the world this year. And yet, a year ago, we barely knew the name Lupita Nyong'o. That was until her role as Patsy in the award-winning film 12 Years a Slave earned her an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress, and fans who somehow escaped her riveting performance were captured by her heartfelt acceptance speech.
I want to thank my family for your training and the Yale School of Drama as well for your training. When I look down at this golden statue, may it remind me and every little child that no matter where you're from, your dreams are valid.
You might have wondered about the people she was talking about. One very important person thanked in that speech was Professor Peter Anyang Nyong'o. He might be known most popularly as Lupita's dad, but in his own right, he is a political science professor and a senator in his home country of Kenya. He happened to be in Washington, D.C. for the Smithsonian's Folklife Festival, which features Kenya this year. So what a great opportunity to meet with him and hear what his year has been like. Senator, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
When you heard your daughter thank you and the family for her training, first, what went through your mind, and what was she talking about?
Well, my wife and I were there. We are sitting a little bit far from her and our little boy, Junior. They were together.
Yes, we saw Junior in the famous selfie with Ellen DeGeneres, the host of the Academy Awards. He made quite a striking figure there as well. Yes.
Yeah, but we were as moved as everybody. I mean, I couldn't believe that that was Lupita talking. We call her Amondi. But, of course, most well-known name is Lupita. So, you know, as a parent, you get kind of taken aback how wise the little ones have become. And we almost shed tears when we had those words of wisdom. And really, it was quite a wonderful evening.
Well, it capped off on quite a remarkable year for her. I mean, she had been recognized by other professional groups as well for, as you mentioned, not just for her performance, but also for her common sense and for her inspiring words. And you said, as a parent, you're saying you sort of don't think, is that really my child? I mean, had you seen her as all that?
Yeah, she started rather early. I mean, I remember in kindergarten, when she was 5, we went to a Parents' Day, and she was leading a bunch of kids on the stage singing and entertaining parents. And she came on stage singing this Swahili song, which we recorded. I think we still have a version of it somewhere, I hope. And she just did wonders. And that's when we realized that this child is in for something. And, of course, when she went to primary school and then high school, her acting career just blossomed.
Forgive me for asking, but sometimes parents are always thrilled that their children desire a career in acting. Do you remember what your thoughts were about it when you realized that that was her course?
Well, one good thing is that I myself was an actor when I was in high school. And we are thespians, really, in the family. We loved going to plays. I mean, I used to, when we were in the car going to work, recite to them some lines from Shakespeare, which amazed them, especially from Othello, you know, when Othello was wooing Desdemona before her father and telling these stories of his adventures in Africa, the anthropophagi, men whose heads grew beneath their shoulders. And they were just amazed. And so, I mean, these kind of things amazed them and inspired them and say, well, we can also go on stage. And kind of all of them kind of took to the arts, really. Because I myself was a student of literature, political science and philosophy in college. And I kind of didn't see that it is necessary to steamroll a kid into a particular career or not her or his liking. Yeah.
He's still a Shakespeare fan?
I am, and she still is. And I think.
No, you. I was asking you.
Me, of course, yes definitely.
What's your favorite play?
My favorite play, believe you or not, is Richard II.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That is a play I really have liked ever since high school.
Do you remember any of the monologues?
Oh, yes. I think when, you know, Northumberland kind of turned against the king, King Richard. And this particular duke tells him, Northumberland. No, it's actually King Richard himself who tells Northumberland, who was his close confidante, but turned against him to talk to support Bolingbroke against him. Mm. And he had already surrendered the crown and tells Northumberland, time will not be many years from now, ere foul sin gathering head shall break into corruption. Mm-hmm. And thou shalt think, though he give you half, it is too little, helping him to all.
Ah.
And I think that is
bravo.
Something that is very reminiscent of a lot of politics.
I was going to go there next. Actually, that's where I was headed. If you are just joining us, I'm speaking with Peter Anyang Nyong'o. He is a professor of political science, a senator in Kenya, and you might recall that famous name. He is the father of Lupita Nyong'o, the Academy Award winner. Many people have noted Lupita's interesting background. She was born in Mexico. Do you mind sharing why she was born in Mexico?
Because in the 1970s and 80s, we had a lot of political repression in Kenya. Jomo Kenyatta died in 1978 in August, and we all expected the new president, who was Jomo Kenyatta's vice president, Daniel Arap Moi, to be a kind of more liberal and expand the political space. Unfortunately, he became even more repressive. And we were teaching the University of Nairobi then, and both students and lecturers, we were kind of opposed to this kind of political repression, this kind of presidential authoritarian regime.
You and your wife, both were professors,
sure.
Yes.
No, my wife was not a professor. My wife, actually, let me confess, when I started teaching, my wife was in the third year at undergraduate, and I spotted her and then married her 2 years after that. So maybe I was raiding the credit, but that's okay.
And it's okay now.
It's okay now.
Anyway,
but then I was teaching at the University of Nairobi, and we were organizing against the regime, and of course, a lot of repression, and I was put in every so often into police custody and so on. And it became really rough. My younger brother disappeared mysteriously at the coast. So I pleaded with the university to let me go. And fortunately, I got an invitation to Mexico at El Colegio de Mexico to go and help them establish an African Studies Center and teach there. So we took off, my family and I. Well, a small family, my wife and the eldest daughter, Zawadi. We went there in December 81, and in March 83, Lupita was born.
Hmm.
And the name Lupita is very important because it's kind of a combination of Luo and the name Peter. The word Lu in Luo means to follow, and Peter is, of course, my name, Peter. Mm-hmm. So we got this name Lupita, which is really a diminutive form for Guadalupe, the patron saint of the Mexicans. And so we called her Lupita.
Well, that's lovely, and she is truly a child of both Mexico and of Kenya. I think she seems to be equally loved by both, and of course, well, as Americans as well. At one point, you went back to Kenya, and the repression continued, if
you
don't mind my mentioning this. This was not an easy time. I think this is not a story that is, well, perhaps as well known in the States, but you were subject to many of the tactics of a repressive regime, constant harassment, arrest.
Yeah.
So forth.
Yeah, well, Lupita says a little bit of it in the current issue of Vogue in July. I was reading it this morning off the internet. But you see, what happened was that when we were in Mexico, Mexico was rather far from home. You see, those days there were no emails, there were no WhatsApp. These things were not there. So you had to write a letter or call. Now, calling was very expensive. And unfortunately, when we were in Mexico, my wife lost her grandmother. And that was quite a terrible experience because we can't even go to the funeral. It was too far. We knew 2 weeks after she was buried. So we said, look, we have to move nearer home. We can't stay here for too long. And we loved Mexico. We wanted to stay here for a longer time. But then I arranged and I got a job with the United Nations organization. We moved to New York in December of 83. But my family didn't like New York. So in April of 84, I leave a UN job and go back to teaching. But then we couldn't keep away from the politics. So it started all over again. And I think in the 80s, it was really rough before we got the democratic opening of the 90s. Yeah, but those days were not easy.
How did you cope with that? May I ask, how were you treated while in custody?
Well, fortunately for me, I didn't get physical torture. I mean, the kind of beating that my other colleagues got. I mean, I was a little lucky in that regard. What one got was psychological torture. I mean, being kept in isolation, being interviewed, harassed, all kinds of things. Humiliation, really. I mean, for example, I remember a place called the Nyayo Dungeons. This was the basement of the Nyayo building. And you go there, you're kept in a tiny little cell, dark, with the bulb up there in the roof. And you don't go out, and you can't go and wash, cold shower, no soap. There was no way to brush your teeth, no way to comb your hair. So, really, it makes you feel bad about yourself. Mm. And then, of course, there's no towel to dry yourself. So you go back to the little cell, and you have to run around the cell several times to get dry. And that is good, because now that I remember, it was good exercise, because if you had sat down, it would have been terrible. But that was kind of conditions that we were kept in.
It's remarkable, because I think people who have seen 12 Years a Slave will remember this pivotal and just horrifying scene of humiliation involving Lupita's character, Patsy, not having soap. It's about her not being able to wash herself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's horrible to consider even now. I wonder, did she know about your experience? Did it inform, you think, her performance, knowing that you had experienced something not the same, but reminiscent?
Reminiscent. But I always tell people that really when I saw 12 Years a Slave, ours was like a dinner party. I mean, 12 Years a Slave was really, really horrific. I mean, when I saw it, then I said, well, we didn't really go through this kind of hell. But nonetheless, we told the kids the stories, not everything. But of course, I remember one day when I came back home from about a month of incarceration, the kids were really shocked, because when I came in, the hair was unkempt. I mean, they could see the disheveled condition. But we had to tell them the stories. I think they grew up, particularly Lupita, because she was very, very close to me, knowing what was happening. They knew that life was not that easy, especially if you stand for something. And I think it also helped us instill in them some principles and not take life for granted. And also to stand up for themselves, because we knew that very often the family was isolated. People couldn't come to visit us, because those days when you are known as a government dissident, a lot of people kept away from you. So that also helped the family come closer together.
Well, also the uncertainty, as you mentioned, your brother disappeared.
Yeah.
And his body was never found.
Yes, yes.
And there was never any definitive account of what happened to him. So it must have been terrifying to have you be taken away.
Yeah.
And not knowing when you would return.
Lupita was still very young. And I think she didn't say much, but I think these things registered in her mind, you see. So I think that amount of uncertainty, of not knowing whether daddy will be there tomorrow or not, I think these things did register in their conscience.
Mm. You know, sometimes when people have gone through all the things that you have gone through, and you are back in public life as a senator, it puts certain pressure on kids to follow the example set by their parents. And I just wondered, you know, for you, I'm interested in your decision to go back into public life after all that you went through. And also, do you have some expectation for your own children about whether there's something that you feel is expected of them as a consequence of all that you have experienced? Do you understand?
I do understand what you're saying. Well, you see, my going into public life was something that came logically. I mean, we were struggling against this authoritarian regime. So when multi-party politics came, we had to take the responsibility or shepherding the democratic process. It was not just me. We were quite a group. In those days, we were known as Young Turks. I think now. I don't
know. Now just Turks.
Now just Turks. Now you're just Turks. No longer young. But anyway, but we had to take the responsibility of carrying the struggle along. And of course, one of the things that pleases me is that now at least we have a new constitution, which is a much more progressive constitution than any we have had before. And I hope that as the struggle continues, when it is implemented, life will be very different from the past. Of course, that also depends on politics. But to come back to your question, I don't think that I want my kids to follow my footsteps. No. My wife and I were very clear about that. Our feeling is that the kids should follow what they feel is their calling.
Obviously, as a parent, you must be very proud of your daughter, all of your children, but we're talking about, you know, Lupita now. But what do you think is the meaning of what has happened, you know, with her? Not just the awards for her acting, but all of the acclaim about her beauty and her style and her elegance. Does it have any importance in your view?
Well, it does. I mean, the beauty and the style and the dressing and all that we never really expected. I mean, look, that came to us as a surprise. I guess as a parent, you don't really appreciate this. But I was surprised. I never knew. But when all this happened, then there came this conversation she had been having with her mom about beauty. They never told me. I learned, like everybody else, that it was something that was important in their lives. And of course, the mother kept on affirming to her that she was beautiful. And so I think when this happened, at her level, it was a fantastic affirmation of what the mother instilled in her to believe in herself. And I think, to me, it helped give her strength that there is more to you than you think, and that you should give the best of yourself to the world. And I think that the thing that she's trying to strive as is always to do her best in whatever she does, but do it in the service of humanity.
Well, thank you for coming in to speak with us.
Yeah.
Of course, you're a very important person in your own right, as a professor, as a scholar, and also as a senator. But, you know, I do have to ask, are there any special perks to being the father of an Oscar winner? Do you get, you know, special treatment?
Not a jot.
Not a jot?
If anything, I have lost my identity, because now, thank you for calling me professor and senator and somebody. Everybody else said Baba Lupita.
Baba Lupita, Lupita's dad.
Lupita's dad. So I've been complaining that I'm losing my identity. So an endangered species, as it were.
Well, I'm sure some dinner reservations will be easier to get now, perhaps.
I hope so. I hope so.
Yeah. Baba Lupita, Peter Anyang Nyong'o, is a Kenyan senator. And as we mentioned, the father of Oscar winner Lupita Nyong'o. He is, as we've mentioned, a member of the Kenyan Senate in his own right and a professor of political science. And he was kind enough to join us in our studios while on a trip to Washington, D.C. to participate in the Smithsonian Folklife Festival, which is presenting Kenya this year and the culture of Kenya as a part of its portfolio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.